Okay. For those of you who weren't here for some of the first ones that we did for the first two installments of this, we first started to talk about Constantine, who was emperor starting in 312 AD until about 340. And he became a Christian early on, and that started the Christianization of the Roman Empire. And set this direction. In the second installment, we talked about Theodosius, who was emperor from about 379 to about 395 or something like that. He sort of turned Rome into the home stretch on Christianity. Constantine had legalized Christianity. Theodosius outlawed paganism. And he went a lot farther than Constantine ever had. And we talked a little bit about the Emperor Justinian, too, who ruled it's called Byzantium on this, it's Constantinople. He was an Eastern emperor. He ruled in the 6th century after the West had fallen. And he sort of completed this, the logic of what had come before. But the problem with that, with having a Christianized Roman Empire, is the whole western half of it is going to crumble and fall, okay, mainly to barbarian invaders, and we're going to talk about that, what it means to be an invader or how much of this was an invasion. But the whole western half of the empire went bye-bye, and if it was Christianized, And all of our Christian heritage really comes from this area. This is Eastern Orthodoxy over here, but the Western Church is where all of our roots are. Then what happened when the barbarians took over? So that's what we're going to try to cover tonight. Getting these barbarians into the empire, getting them settled, to discuss why it was that the Roman Empire fell is really going to take more time than Christianizing them, actually. The Christianization part will do that, but that's actually pretty easy once you get them in there. So, who were these barbarians and where did they come from? The word barbarian derives from the Greek, and it's supposed to invoke the sound of other languages to the Greek ear, bar, 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 okay? For the Romans, barbarians were simply the peoples on their frontiers whose culture wasn't as advanced as Rome's was, which was virtually everybody except for the Greeks and the Egyptians. They didn't call when the Greeks were, before their province was taken over, they didn't call them barbarians. They didn't call the Egyptians barbarians. But pretty much everybody else was barbarian in terms of the Romans. And as their territory is conquered, of course, they become provinces. Gaul was conquered first by Julius Caesar, and before that was in about 46 BC. Before that, these guys were the barbarians. Then they became a province, and they were provincials. And then pretty soon, after about 212, they were declared Roman citizens. For our purposes tonight, we're going to be talking in the time period from about 300 to about 500 AD. That's the time when the Western Empire crumbled and fell. That's the time when the barbarians came and took over. The main groups of barbarians in the north and west up here were the Visigoths, the Ostrogoths, the Vandals, the Franks, and the Huns. And I'm going to have a handout later, so if you don't remember all that, you'll have it in front of you pretty soon. Other smaller groups were the Alans, the Suaves, the Alemans, the Burgundians, and later on the Lombards. The invaders of Britain are a special case that we won't be dealing with. Britain is a special case in all of history, and they're just a pain in the neck, and they are out of here. We're not going to deal with them. The histories of most of these groups are very hazy. Many of them formed from alliances of smaller groups. Except for the Huns, they were mainly Germanic-speaking peoples that seem to have come from now, mostly from now what is Scandinavia, which is up here. northeastern Germany and Poland, these areas in here. They displaced and absorbed the Celtic peoples. It used to be that Europe was all Celtic prior in Jesus' time and before, but they displaced and absorbed these Celtic peoples from where they came from Central Europe, and some of them from the Russian steppes in the first 250 years AD. The Alans, that little group I talked about, were the only ones that were probably non-Germanic. They were Iranians who came from the steppes. The barbarians, of course, are not as culturally advanced as the Romans. They did, in areas that they were used their expertise a lot, they had a lot of expertise. They were great warriors. They also had good carts, which sounds funny because to call that out, but I mean, they didn't do, the Romans were, of course, a seafaring nation, but here, stuck in Europe, the barbarians developed a lot of technologies for moving things over the ground relatively well, and the Romans took a lot of that technology from them. The average Germanic barbarians tended to be larger. The men were 5'8 or 5'9. Then the Romans, the typical Roman soldier was either 5'3 or 5'4. People were smaller back then. Nutritional thing, I guess. The barbarians were somewhat nomadic. They had subsistence economies. There were no towns of any size. That's going to be an important thing to remember a little bit later on. No cities, no towns. A small hamlet was about as big as they got. And raiding between groups was a way of life for these folks. Around 300 AD, these groups were pre-literate, but by about 600 AD, those that were remaining were at best semi-literate. However, they were keenly aware of the organization and success of the Romans, and they appreciated the need for writing and reading. And this is going to be a big tie into Christianity, because once the Romans are gone, what's the only institution left in Western Europe? The church. And Christianity is not only literacy, it's fluency. A lot of the works that we have now, the literary works that we have now from antiquity, were transmitted all through, basically through Christian monks who copied all the manuscripts and kept them. And that the barbarians were going to very much appreciate that and use that and get together with people, with Christians, and use their talents in that regard as they move on. The Romans had traded with the barbarians for about as long as the barbarians had occupied the lands adjacent to their provinces. So there was trading going on. One of the video professors that I saw, Riley, said that if it wasn't trading, then the Romans were throwing all their empties across the Rhine and the Danube into the barbarians' territory. There was always some immigration going on across the borders. It's estimated that in the provinces right along the frontiers, approximately 20% of the people there in any given time would be barbarians who had come across within one generation. Okay. The Romans would head from, you know, for a long time, probably since about the time of Christ or a little bit before. It always taken a few barbarians into the army, and there were some barbarian auxiliaries to the army. Yes?
Barbarians just hunters then, or did they produce crops?
They did some crop production. In those little hamlets, there was always some agriculture going on. That was done mostly by the women and older children, and the men usually were out hunting game. Okay, so that's sort of who the barbarians were and where they came from. Now we're going to talk a little bit about why the Western Roman Empire fell. This is a subject of endless debate among historians. So I'm going to give you kind of a general outline and stick to the main paths of modern scholarly opinion. First thing you need to talk about there is depopulation. And this is one of the primary causes. The empire had reached its maximum land area early in the second century. By late in the second century, disease was sweeping the empire. This disease was theorized to be smallpox or measles, but probably both. And the toll was huge. Over a few decades, some historians estimate that up to a half of the population was killed. If not a half, then a third for sure. And this came at a time when Rome had larger frontiers than ever to defend. They just did all this expanding, and then they lost a lot of people. Archaeology has revealed from the second century onward that the inhabited area in most Roman towns and cities grew smaller and smaller. Imperial laws concerning agri deserti, or deserted lands, became increasingly common and desperate. So there's good evidence that they were shrinking. Effects on the barbarians, still in Central Europe at this time, were less, as they didn't have these large population centers to spread the disease and to focus the disease like the Romans had. This depopulation was a major factor in the economic and military crises in the third century, which we talked about when we talked about Constantine. And it led to increasing reliance on barbarians to man the army. Less people also meant less taxes with which to supply the army. Also during the crises of the third century, there were several civil wars. A lot of people, especially soldiers, got killed. During those civil wars, there's more population loss. So that's cause number one. Cause number two is pressure from the barbarians, which is what we're going to talk about. So I'm going to leave that one for a second and continue to the other causes. Another cause was the Persians. In 224, the Persians defeated the Parthians. The Parthians used to control what we would call Iran and Iraq out here on the map. And they were defeated by the Persians. The Romans and the Parthians had come to sort of a stalemate. So this eastern frontier prior to 224 was not too much of a problem for the Romans. When the Persians took over, it became a major problem for the Romans. So they had to take more resources out of the west to take care of the eastern frontier. Civil wars, another cause. There was never a very good system for succession of emperors, and the reforms of Diocletian, who we talked about in our first, the Emperor Diocletian, who we talked about in our first installment, in the late 3rd century, he split the empire into east and west, right about along that line. And he had a senior and a junior emperor in each half. We did talk about that. Initially, that worked well, but in the longer haul, it just provided more fodder for civil wars. There was more guys who were jockeying for position for emperor. The Romans lost. In the 4th century, the Romans lost over 100,000 soldiers in two civil wars, one at Mursa in 351 and one at the Frigidus River in 394. That's one we talked about last time. That was Theodosius. And those are both... Those are both in the Balkans here, in Mursa and the Frigidus River. 100,000 soldiers, that's about 20% of Rome's army gone in two civil wars. Last cause, this one is a little bit less sort of immediate, but it had an impact, is imperial autocracy. From the time of the Emperor Diocletian, and especially from Constantine forward, the emperor became more and more of an absolute autocrat. The mission of the army went from guarding the frontier to guarding the emperor. And loyalty changed from Roman patriotism to loyalty to the emperor. And then it sort of transitioned to loyalty to your general, who might be vying with the emperor to try to get that next emperor position. That wasn't how it was in the old days in Rome. And Roman soldier was in it for Rome, for the good of the, you know, people and country. But that switched during this time period that we're talking about, during 300 to 500. And this might have been good for the emperor in the short term, but it was really bad for the empire in the long run. Okay. So now let's talk about focusing on the barbarians and the Romans during the decline of the West. Up through the 3rd century, besides trading and controlled immigration, as we've already talked about, the relationship of the Romans and barbarians here on the northern and western frontiers was mostly well-defined. The barbarians would occasionally invade, and the Romans would defeat and expel them. Starting during the reign of Constantine, and increasingly over the 4th century and beyond, this relationship changed, largely as a result of the Roman depopulation and the other causes that we talked about. I'm going to give you a number of things that happened, and all of these things occurred, and this is arranged very roughly in time order. Rather than trying to give you a lot of examples, we're just going to go over these, this kind of bulleted list of things that happened, and that hopefully will paint the picture for you. Barbarians served in the Roman army for the right to citizenship after a certain number of years. Barbarians served in the Roman army for pay. Barbarian groups just outside the empire were compensated by the Romans to guard the border. That happened during the time of Constantine. Some barbarians who had been captured by the Romans as children and made slaves returned to their groups as adults and became leaders. So now you've got some barbarian leaders who know all about the Romans and their ways. And they speak good Latin, too. Most barbarian groups alternated being friendly to the Romans and being hostile against them, whatever was expedient at the time. The Romans often played one barbarian group against another, and barbarians also tried a similar game. Some barbarian soldiers reached the highest ranks in the army. They became generals. They were good fighters. Some barbarian groups were allowed into the empire by treaty, usually in depopulated frontier areas, and were given responsibility for guarding the border against other barbarian groups. So who's minding the store here? Okay. Most barbarian groups that were allowed inside the empire either agitated or rebelled as part of maneuvering for a better deal from the Romans. I'm going to see an example of that in a minute. A few Roman army units were made up entirely of barbarians, sometimes splinter groups. This is especially true of the Huns. The Huns, before Attila, did not have a very cohesive structure. And there were splinter groups of Huns, some of which went over and became army units for the Romans. A few barbarian groups, and this is especially true of the Huns, were paid tribute by the Romans to refrain from attacking Roman territory. That occurred the latest of any of these things that I've just listed. But you can see that by that time, the Romans are getting pretty desperate, right? They're paying essentially blackmail money to groups to say, oh, you know, please don't attack us. So without going through the details of many actual events, this list paints sort of a broad brush picture of the complexity of what has often been referred to as the barbarian invasion of the Roman Empire. Barbarians did sometimes invade, but were just as often invited or allowed in. One thing that's sort of important of this whole time is that the other barbarian groups were terrified of the Huns. When the Huns first moved into Eastern and Central Europe around 370, they pressured other groups to move out of their way and into the empire. The Huns were steppe nomads that came from this southern steppes of what we now call Russia. And they moved in. They were tough people. They could shoot arrows from horseback better than anybody, and they could also fight with spears from horseback. And the barbarians that were here in Central Europe at that time, they were just overwhelmed by that. Okay, my assistant is going to pass out some handouts. Yes.
Were the Cossacks, were they somehow part of this? was the... No.
Russians, yeah.
Yeah.
No. No, those are more northern folks. Oh, it was just the Huns from the steppe area. Okay. What you've got on this handout on one side is a timeline, and time is going from left to right there, starting in 350 and going to 550 AD. And then as you move down the page, you're getting different lanes. We're talking about the Visigoths at the top, the Vandals, then the Roman Empire, then the Franks and the Huns and the Ostrogoths down at the bottom. And then you have this cute little map on the back that has some arrows pointing about where a lot of these barbarian groups went during this time period. And what I'm going to do is, as examples, I'm going to use the Visigoths and the Vandals. And I'm going to run through how they got into the empire and what happened to them. If you want to follow along on your timeline, you can. I'm going to give you a little bit more detail on those two than on the rest. And then after we get done with the Visigoths and the Vandals, we'll take a quick look at the other ones. Okay. Because of the pressure from the recently arrived Huns, in 376, the Visigoths requested permission from the Emperor Valens to enter the empire across the Danube, right here in from what is now Romania, down into the Balkans. They received permission from the Emperor Valens to do that, and then in return they were supposed to help guard this border. Okay, Romans were always hurting for troops at that time, and if they could get somebody else to guard the border that they thought could do it, that's what they would do. However, more of these Visigoths came into the empire than were expected. Local Roman officials began to mistreat them. For example, giving them much-needed food only in trade for their children as slaves. This caused the Visigoths to become unruly. They didn't like that. And in 378, the Emperor Valens went to tamp down this problem, but he went with inadequate forces. He was defeated and killed by the Visigoths. In 380, the new emperor Theodosius calmed this situation down by negotiating with the Visigoths. He had too many problems on his hands to fight them, so he negotiated. They settled in the Balkans more or less peaceably, starting in 380. After the death of Theodosius in 395, his unworthy sons rose to the throne, Honorius in the west and Arcadius in the east. This is when we've got two emperors going, one in Rome and one in Constantinople. The two sons despised each other, and they tried to use Alaric, who was the king of the Visigoths, as a pawn to sort of bat between them. They tried to play him, each one to invade the other's turf. What Alaric wanted was a Roman generalship. The Visigoths wanted to become part of the game with the Romans, and Alaric wanted to become a general. He didn't get what he wanted, and he was tired of being played by Honorius and Arcadius, so he started raiding in the Balkans in 400. He started raiding Roman towns. In 401, he took about 20,000 Visigoths with him northwest towards Italy. To counter this, a very powerful half-Vandal Western general named Stilicho, okay, we've got a general now in Italy, who's half Vandal, he's half barbarian. He marched his army northeast in Italy to block Alaric from coming in. They fought some indecisive battles. Neither one of them could make progress, so Alaric just settled down and he started biding his time in what is now Slovenia. At that point, the capital of the West was moved from Rome to Ravenna, which is, they went across the peninsula and a little bit northeast. Ravenna's right up here. Why did they go to Ravenna? It's surrounded by swamps. It's very difficult to attack. And they were sensing that they were going to start to have some real trouble with the Visigoths. So they moved to an area that was tougher to attack. In 406, with this situation in Italy, still a standoff between Alaric and Stilicho, there's a very cold winter which freezes the Rhine over its length. Okay, now the Romans, that was the border here between their territory and what they called Germania, where the barbarians were. And of course they had bridges across the Rhine, but all those bridges were garrisoned. And they weren't, you know, wide bridges like you have now. So anybody that tried to cross the Rhine was going to be immediately challenged by the Romans. When the Rhine froze over its length, it was open season. Anybody could come across and in whatever numbers. So what happened, the Vandals and the Alans and the Suaves all piled into the empire in December of 406. And they pillaged their way through Gaul and Spain. Now, this one was an invasion. The Visigoths were invited in or allowed to come in. The Vandals were not. They invaded across the frozen Rhine and just pillaged their way through Gaul. It was nasty. Back in Rome, or back in Italy, excuse me, in 408, Stilicho is assassinated, so Alaric made his move, and he marched unopposed to Rome, and he arrived there in 410. He was paid a large bounty to leave the city alone, and he was made master of the soldiers by the Senate, and that's the highest rank in the army. Alaric and the Visigoths then decided that what they really wanted to do was come down and settle in North Africa. The Senate, however, was opposed to that. So on August 24th through the 26th in 410, Alaric and the Visigoths sacked Rome. What does it mean to sack a city? I've always had problems when people use that terminology. It can mean almost anything. At the light end, it means looting. At the heavy end, it means a lot of casualties. This was light, as sackings go. They pretty much looted Rome. Still, even though it was kind of light, it was a shock to the whole world, and it prompted Augustine to write his book, The City of God. For the first time, the city of Rome had been invaded since 389 BC, and that was by the Gauls at that time. So it's the first time in, what, almost 800 years. After they sacked Rome, Alaric and the Visigoths headed down the peninsula of Italy to see if they could arrange passage to North Africa. That didn't work, so they head back up towards Rome. If you look on your little colored map, you'll see that there's this line goes down and then comes back up. Alaric died on the way, and he was replaced by his brother Adewulf. Nice name. Great name for a barbarian. He marched the Visigoths back up Italy and into southern Gaul and in 411. The Visigoths settled down in southern Gaul, and in 418 they got a treaty with Rome. They had to suppress brigandage in Gaul, guard the western coast, and help the Romans fight the Vandals, Alans, and Suaves in Spain. So you can see they're on the Roman side, they're against them. Okay, they were invited in, they killed the emperor. They settled down in the Balkans for a while, they sacked Rome. He was made master of the soldiers, they get a treaty. So it's very complex. They're not on one side or the other. They keep sort of flip-flopping. The Vandals, meanwhile, so we've got the Visigoths settled down here in the south of what is now France, Gaul. The Vandals, meanwhile, are now settled in Spain. They have pillaged their way through Gaul, and they settled down in Spain. They also tried to get a treaty with Rome. However, since they were invaders and had done a great deal of harm to Gaul as they pillaged through it, the Romans were having none of that. Seeing opportunity in North Africa, and with pressure from the Visigoths and the Romans in Spain, the Vandals jumped over the Strait of Gibraltar. It's only 9 miles, so they crossed the strait, and they begin a successful campaign of conquest in North Africa. They reached Hippo Regius, there it is, right there, in 430. And they were besieging it as Augustine was literally laying on his deathbed. North Africa was a very important source of cereal grains, wine, olive oil, and taxes for the Romans. So as the Vandals' influence expanded there, they often cut off these supplies to Rome and tried to bargain for advantages. By 439, the Vandals had taken Carthage here. And in 440, they took Sicily, after which they also grabbed Sardinia and Corsica, the islands off of Italy here. In 442, the Romans finally gave in and gave the Vandals a treaty and a marriage alliance to try to get their supplies running again. Strong indication of how weak the Romans are getting. In their salad days, they would have gone and crushed the Vandals. They didn't have the strength to do it. They had to use whatever means were necessary to try and stop this. So they gave in and gave them a treaty. In 455, this marriage alliance went bad. And to emphasize their displeasures, the Vandals came up and sacked Rome. So Rome is getting hit again and again. Pope Leo I, who was the Pope at that time, pleaded with the Vandals for mercy. And so this sacking, too, could have been far worse. It was mostly just looting. While all that stuff is going on, the Visigoths are taking advantage of opportunities to expand their turf in Gaul, even though that's against their treaty. But the Romans don't bother to even try to stop them. In 507, there was another group had come in that we're going to get to in a minute, the Franks. And they were expanding down from the northeast in Gaul. And in 507, the expanding Franks handed the Visigoths a devastating defeat at Bouillé. And after that, the Visigoths are pretty much confined to Spain. They turned around and headed for Spain. They remained in Spain until Spain was taken over by the Muslims in the 8th century. The Vandals enjoyed a lot of success in North Africa until the Emperor Justinian, and we talked about him last time, by way of his great general Belisarius, defeated them in 532 through 534. So that is a little bit of a detailed look at one invasion and one invited in and then sort of ping-ponged around the whole empire until they ended up here in Spain. The Visigoths and the Vandals. If you look at your timelines now, we'll just sort of quickly take a look at some of the other groups. We've got things going on there in Rome in the across the center. Rome abandoned Britain. When things got tough in Gaul, Rome abandoned Britain. They just didn't have the manpower to handle it. You could see when the capital moved to Ravenna. In the 5th century, things are getting creaky in the 4th century. In the 5th century, the old order really begins to completely break down in the Western Empire. Until a barbarian general named Odovaker deposed the last Western emperor. That happened in 476. Everybody says the Roman Empire fell in 476. It's not true. I mean, it was sliding for 150 years at least before that. Interesting that in 550, the Senate finally ceased operation after 1,000 years. The Roman Senate went on for 1,000 years. And what were they doing? I mean, What's that?
I said, what were they doing? I said, filibuster.
Oh. That is funny. They were just running things locally. Once control in the West broke down and you had the Eastern Empire was still going on, but once control in the West broke down, the Roman Senate was just controlling things right in their little local area. The Franks, next line there. If you look back on your map, the Franks are just this orange line that kind of comes in like this. But they're really some of the most important of the barbarians because they're the ones who are going to end up controlling virtually all of what we call now Western Europe. Spain's a special case, which doesn't really get under control until 1492. But just after 350, they had a treaty with the soon-to-be Emperor Julian to occupy northeastern Gaul. They got in there, they started expanding. They had a leader named Clovis. You may, if you've read some history, you may have heard of him. He actually, the Romans said, yeah, it's okay for you to come in. He ended up fighting the Romans on and off. He defeated the last Romans in the north in about 485 or something like that. He married a Catholic Burgundian princess. We're going to talk about that in the Christianization part. But in about 510, he had a victory over the Visigoths at Bouillé, and they started expanding down into the southern part of Gaul here. Last line, Huns and Ostrogoths. I put them together because I didn't have enough room on the sheet, and the Huns come first and the Ostrogoths come later, so there really wasn't any crossover in time. The Huns migrated from the steppes to Eastern and Central Europe around 370. They immediately subjugated the Ostrogoths, so the Ostrogoths were sort of under their thumb. They start raiding first in the west, and then in the west, and extracting tribute from the empire. They didn't ever want to actually, it's arguable whether they wanted to come in and take over pieces of the empire. They never stayed in the empire for very long. They'd come in, they'd do some raiding, they'd leave again. As you can see there, Attila was the co-ruler in the early parts of the 5th century, and then he became the sole ruler in about 443 or something A.D. If you look on your maps, you've got the Huns coming in. They had this little, there's a little cross there, Chalon, 451. There was a big battle there between the Huns and the Romans. The Romans had the Visigoths helping them at the time. A lot of historians used to think that was really a terribly significant battle, and that the Huns were trying to take over all of Gaul when they did that. Recent view is that they really weren't. They were just out doing some raiding, and they were in full retreat by the time that battle at Chalon actually happened. Once they came back from there, they came down into Italy, and they were threatening Rome. Pope Leo turned back Attila from Rome, and that was a sort of a big plus for the papacy. People heard about that. It gave the papacy some real legitimacy that he went out, he had the guts to ride out and meet Attila and somehow talked him out of sacking Rome. Attila died relatively soon after that, and the Huns really fell apart. He was the one keeping the Huns together. The Huns dissipated and got absorbed into other groups at that point. Now that the Huns are gone, the Ostrogoths are free to do what they want, and they entered the Balkans not long after that, in about 475 or so. The Ostrogoths came into Italy then. That's where they ended up. They defeated this guy called Odovaker, who was the one who deposed the last Western Roman emperor. And they were recognized. Theodoric, who was the king of the Ostrogoths, was recognized by the emperor just prior to 500 AD, and they ruled Italy for about 50 years until Justinian thought that it was time that they be ousted. That was probably a bad idea. They were actually doing quite a good job in ruling Italy.
What so, mean
to be recognized? As legitimate, okay. He wasn't, nobody ever tried to be emperor of the West ever again. Odovaker never did. He didn't say, I'm the emperor. In fact, he took all the official emperor stuff, like the crown and the signet ring and all that, and he sent it to Constantinople. He said, we don't need an emperor here in the West anymore. And it was the same thing with Theodoric. They just sort of wanted to rule locally. Okay. So those are the main groups. And we sort of got them all in the empire now. How did they get Christianized? Well, as goes the prince, so go the people is, in a nutshell, the story behind the conversion of the barbarians. In the 340s, the half-Gothic Arian bishop Ulfilas went as a missionary to the Gothic peoples, to the Visigoths and the Ostrogoths. Again, back in the 340s, that was when Constantine's son was emperor. Unfortunately, this guy was an Arian, okay, which is a heresy that Christ was a created being. That was Arianism. Was, as we talked about, was very big in the empire in the 4th century. Ulfilas also invented a written language for the Goths at that point, and he translated the Bible into it. I think he used Greek characters to make their language. This was the beginning of literacy for the Goths, and the leaders, when he went in there in the 340s, the leaders and therefore the people of the Visigoths and the Ostrogoths were converted to Arian Christianity by 350, before they ever entered the empire. So by the time the Visigoths got in and the Ostrogoths got in, they were, at least nominally speaking, Christians. Arians. We're going to take care of that in a minute. But, the Vandals, in a similar fashion, were converted to Arian Christianity a bit later as they were living near the Danube. They were right up here living right above the Danube. During the reign of the Emperor Valens, when the Visigoths were down in here in the Balkans. They were also converted by missionaries. The Franks were converted by two events. The Franks, again, remember, came in up in the north, in the north part of Gaul. First, in 493, their leader Clovis married a Burgundian princess, whose name was Clotilda. She had been born in Lyon in France and raised as a Catholic / Nicene Christian. Several years later, in 496, he won a crucial victory over the Alemans, which is another barbarian group, and he believed that God helped him to win this victory, and so he was baptized shortly after that, along with about 3,000 of his soldiers. This conversion is really pivotal for the future of medieval Europe because the Franks are going to take over the store up there. They're going to be the whole deal in a few hundred years. The Huns were never converted as a group, but they ceased to be a united force in 453. The Vandals were never converted to Nicene Christianity, but as they were defeated by Justinian, they ceased to be the rulers of North Africa and Sicily, and they sort of faded into the background. The Ostrogoths were also never converted to Nicene Christianity, but they were defeated by Justinian. After they retreated north into what is now Austria, their influence as a group sort of also dissipated. The Visigoths are a more interesting case. They started as Arians, as we said, coming down in, and they were converted well before they ever even entered the empire. They ended up ruling Spain for close to 300 years until the Muslim takeover in 718. However, before the Visigoths arrived, the church had a strong presence in Spain. And so Nicene Catholic bishops were in all the major towns and cities there. They looked for opportunities to convert the Visigoths, who were tolerant of their presence. And in 587, a bishop whose name was Leander in Seville was able to convert the just elevated king, whose name was Recared, to Catholic Christianity, and his people soon followed. So the Visigoths got converted here just before 600 AD by the bishop in Seville. I will go back to what I said and talk very briefly about Britain. It had been nominally Christian as it was part of the Roman Empire, abandoned by the Romans in 401, and the takeover by the Angles and the Saxons over the next two centuries pushed Christianity to the margins in Britain. In 597, Pope Gregory the Great sent missionaries to Britain, at first under a monk who was named Augustine. They were tolerated by the Anglo-Saxons, and re-Christianization began. any damage to this re-Christianization that was caused by the Viking invasions of the 10th century was undone by the Norman conquest of the 11th century. So Britain is a hard case. You could spend weeks on it. They were invaded by everybody and their brother. Ultimately, though, the people that got there ultimately ended up with control were the Normans, and they were Christians by the time they got there. That leaves us with Italy. Soon after the Ostrogoths left Italy, the Lombards, which is another barbarian group, entered in the 560s. They splintered once they got there, and Italy became a tangle of small duchies, and it remained so until the 19th century. If anybody knows anything about the history of Italy, I mean, it was a mess. You look at a map, and it's just all chopped up into these little duchies and little, almost like city-states, all the way up until the 19th century. But the Lombards entered the empire as pagans, but some became Arians, and many became Catholics because the church is still there in Rome, and the church has a big influence in Christianizing those people who came into Italy and stayed there. Any questions? Yes, Alice.
Was the Visigoth invasion that prompted the development of Venice?
Of what?
Venice, the city of Venice. When we were in Venice, the history they told us was that because of the shallowness of the sea and the swamps, as you mentioned, mm-hmm. in Ravenna, that they created the city that was basically hard to invade to escape to.
Do you know when the city was founded? You can just about tell by the timing. If it was sometime around 400 AD, then the answer would be yes, because that's where the threat was coming from at that point.
Randy,
yes, Dean?
You may have said this, I just missed it, but as these various barbarian tribes came across, did they have any sort of organized religious ideas or practices, or did they...
Beforehand. Not a lot is known about that. They were certainly pagans, and anything that they get comes from, of course, since they were all pre-literate, they don't have any writings from these people. It's all archaeology that they've dug up. You know, they had a war god, Odin, and you may have heard that name. That was one that the archaeologists have found a lot about, but that seemed to be their big focus was war, and that's the only one that I've heard about.
That's kind of Odin's sort of Scandinavian, right?
Yes, right, yeah. Because a lot of these folks, again, you can't tightly identify these groups with ethnicity, but still, a lot of them, particularly the Goths, were Scandinavian. Right. Yes, Rick?
I was going to say that, you know, the barbarian gods around Tui, Odin, Thor, and Frey are where we get Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and
Friday. Oh, okay. One interesting point about Rome and Ravenna was that the church felt that they needed access to Ravenna. And as Italy was all broken up into these little splinters, they started to, and if I do another one of these things, it's going to be on the medieval, on Charlemagne and what goes on in early medieval Christianity, but they kind of buddied up with the Franks. That's what started to cement the bond between the church and the Western European governments. And they said, you know, we need some protection down here from all of these crazy people who are running around in Italy. And that's how the Papal States were created. And the Papal States was essentially a bridge from Rome to Ravenna so that the church officials could go back and forth between the capital, which was Ravenna, and Rome in supposed safety. And now you've got papal states, now you've got territory. Pretty soon the church had an army. I mean, they were mercenary armies, but you get the church start to get involved in all of this kind of political stuff, and even with armies. Yes, Rick?
I'm just trying to sort of picture what these guys would might have looked like. I mean, were they, I assume that, well, I ask you, but the Huns were obviously more of an Eastern, but would they, I assume these guys would be, they'd be white, they'd be Caucasian.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
And in, as far as the Romans were concerned, one of the ways they could tell them was that they wore trousers. The Romans didn't do that until maybe 400 AD and farther on. But the Romans always wore their toga-type things, but the barbarians wore trousers. The Romans thought that that was uncouth. They also had, some of the Romans had beard. Very rarely would they have mustaches. The barbarians, almost all of them, had mustaches, so that was also one of the ways they could pick out, oh yeah, the guy's a barbarian.
I tend to, maybe the same thing, you know, in Spain, especially in the southern part, and the Iberian Peninsula as having a fair Islamic or Muslim influence now, you know, coming from like North Africa. So where they, is that the case? And if so, did that come after this or before? Or you know, did they drive out the Visigoths and the Vandals that you show? Or
they,
what was that now? Was there
really that came, okay, well, the outpouring from Saudi Arabia came in 634. That was the original push after Muhammad died. They didn't get to Spain until 712. Okay, so it took them about 100 years to conquer their way through North Africa. But when they did, yes, they took over. The Visigoths had Spain at that time, and they took over for the Visigoths in Spain. But it was, Spain was a very interesting case after that. It became, there was quite a few Jews in Spain as well. And it became a pretty cosmopolitan place. The Muslims there were probably somewhat less radical than some of the ones who were left back east. And they lived in relative peace with the Jews and the Christians in Spain for quite a while. Anything else? Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you.